Hello, and thank you for being with us for this special edition of the History of World War II podcast. Today, we're going to talk with writer and author Jack L. High, who has just come out with his latest book, I believe it was released yesterday, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, Hermann Goering, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, and A Fatal Meeting of Minds at the End of World War II. So, Mr. L. High, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ray, for having me here.
I really do appreciate it. So if we could, in the interest of just kind of jumping in there, could you give us an idea of the an overview of your book and how you came to write it?
Sure. The Nazi and the Psychiatrist is about the intersection of two lives. Mm-hmm. One is the life of Hermann Goering, who I'm sure is familiar to all of your listeners. He was one of the top Nazi leaders, chief of the Luftwaffe, held many other titles and positions in the Nazi German government. And then the second person involved in this intersection is Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, who was a U.S. Army psychiatrist assigned a couple months after the end of the war to meet with and examine the top Nazi prisoners, those who are going to be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Right.
So the book is about what happened when Dr. Kelly arrived first in Luxembourg, where many of the Nazi captives were held, and then later in Nuremberg, and how he developed a plan, which was quite beyond what his military orders were. His orders were simply to evaluate the Nazis to see if they were fit to stand trial, mentally
right.
fit to stand trial. But he developed his own plan, a private scheme, to take advantage of this opportunity he had with the men who were commonly regarded at that time as the criminals of the century.
Yeah.
To see if to not just examine them, but to interview them in depth, test them using various psychological assessments available at the time to see if they shared any psychological disorders or whether Dr. Kelly could identify a Nazi personality or a type of Nazi mind that these men shared. So the book covers all of that and then follows after Goering's death, suicide, covers Dr. Kelly's life over the next 12 years and his spiral downward and how this encounter with the Nazis affected his life and finally resulted in his own suicide on New Year's Day in 1958.
Wow. And I think the way that you, well, I guess maybe stumbled upon the resources that you used for the story is a pretty amazing story in itself.
It is. It's an unusual story for the beginnings of a book, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
It all began with my previous book. I had previously written a book called The Lobotomist.
Mm-hmm.
That was a biography of the psychiatrist and neurologist who developed and championed lobotomy as a treatment for psychiatric illness.
Wow.
But one of this doctor's side interests, besides lobotomy, was the study of his fellow psychiatrists who had taken their own lives. And so he had written some about psychiatrists who had committed suicide,
mm-hmm.
and I read what he wrote, and one of the people he wrote about was Douglas M. Kelly, and in fact, the two men had met in the late 1930s at a medical convention. And what the lobotomy doctor had written about Dr. Kelly really intrigued me. It was pretty sketchy, and there wasn't a lot of information he had, but it was enough to hook me, and
right.
I went out in search of Dr. Kelly's surviving family members and found out how common the family name Kelly is. There are an awful lot of Kellys out there,
right.
but I was finally able to track down Dr. Kelly's oldest son, who is himself in his 60s now, and hoping that the son would have something
mm-hmm.
of his father's career. Maybe I hoped for a few file folders, papers, or some other kinds of memorabilia. And what I found out instead when I visited the son, finally, was that he had more than a few file folders. He had 15 boxes of material, personal and professional papers from his advanced career, including several boxes just stuffed to the brim with materials that he had brought back from Nuremberg, including medical records of the top Nazis, psychiatric records, memos, journals, his examination, his record of his examinations of the Nazis. And I realized that this really was a remarkable treasure trove of materials, and that it could form the basis of a book. So that's how it all got started.
That is amazing. So the son, and it could be certainly understood the way his father died. Maybe he just didn't want to. He wanted to hold on to it, but not do anything with it. But it's just amazing that it was just sitting there in boxes.
It is. I think the fact that all these papers still existed, the credit for that should go to Dr. Kelly's widow, who held on to them until her death, which was probably about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little longer, maybe 10 years ago. And then when she died, the son inherited those papers, and he was holding them. He knew they had historic value.
Mm-hmm.
He knew somebody would want to see them, and it was almost as if he was waiting for someone to get in touch with him. And fortunately, I did at the right time.
That's absolutely amazing. So going back to something you said earlier, I think it's amazing that Dr. Kelly, and from what I was able to gather from your book, he certainly had a healthy-sized ego. He was certainly intelligent, very precocious. So he was going to do what the Army wanted him to do to keep these guys together, help them to make sure they could stand for trial, keep everything, I guess, going smoothly so they can do that. But all at the same time, he decided to sue his own personal course and to try to find a Nazi mentality or a Nazi mind or just something to explain these, like you said, these criminal, the greatest criminals of the century. I just think it takes a tremendous amount of ego and courage to go, I'll do your job, but I'm also going to do mine and not tell you anything about it.
Right. And that was that ego and that high regard for himself was part of what attracted him to Goering. Because as time unfolded in the jail at Nuremberg, and as the two men met over many months, almost daily, it became obvious, I don't know how consciously, but at least below the surface of consciousness to Kelly, that he and Goering had some things in common, and mainly that was their high esteem for themselves and their abilities, and their the high esteem that others saw them with. And that is part of the attraction, I think, that drew these two men together. It wouldn't be right to say that Kelly and Goering became friends or buddies or anything like that, but they did draw close in terms of admiration for the similar qualities found in each. And that's an important part of the dynamic between these two men.
Yeah, that's just amazing. Do you think it would be fair to say that either Goering had a plan going into this, or was he just trying to wing it and survive? Because he certainly saw himself as the greatest living Nazi, since Hitler was gone, and he thought he would maybe be able to get out of all of this, even though he was in a jail when he was being held. But maybe he thought he could outswindle an intelligent person who was trained in psychiatry.
Yes, Goering was a master manipulator, as was Kelly. And so I believe Goering had a plan to use Kelly to his advantage. He did use Kelly to his advantage.
Yeah.
He asked Kelly to carry letters out of the prison to Goering's wife and young daughter. Kelly did that. He assisted Goering in other ways. He was a two-way street because Kelly knew that he could get a lot from his association with Goering, that if he could somehow wheedle his way into this man's mind, then that would be a tremendous scientific finding, something that would bring him a lot of fame and acclaim and could make his career. So what we have in this situation is two master manipulators working at each other.
Right.
And I think, in the best of compromises both getting what they wanted.
Right. One of the things that impressed me about your book was you were able to give a really, I felt like I knew Gehring so much better after reading this. And of course, you talk about Kelly's life as well, and also the history of psychology, the Rorschach test that Kelly performed on all of them, and the amazing responses that they all gave. And of course, all this is leading up to the Nuremberg trials. But he spent time with, I think, the top 22 surviving Nazi people who were getting ready for the trials. Is that correct?
Right. He worked. He examined and met with all of the defendants who were up for trial in the first international tribunal. Mm-hmm. So that right, that was 22 of them, and 21 made it to trial. One of them committed suicide before the trial.
All right. So I think it's amazing. So here's Kelly. He's trying to do what the Army wants: keep these guys together, talk to them, keep them calm. To analyze and make sure that they're okay to stand trial. Yeah, and then, like you said, a suicide. I think it was it Dr. Comte who commits suicide first while in prison?
Right. Yeah. And he was not among the 22, but he was a Nazi medical official. And then a few weeks after Dr. Comte committed suicide, then Robert Ley committed suicide in prison, and he was among the 22. He was the head of the German labor front.
Gotcha. The impression that I got after reading it was, even though they were all Nazis and they were all literally out to carve out their own spheres of influence within the Nazi empire, they were very different men in so many ways, and they in a lot of ways hated each other. But one of the most interesting people in it, besides Gehring and Dr. Kelly, was Rudolf Hess, and faking his entire amnesia, or whatever the proper term is. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Hess was a really unusual case in the prison because, as I'm sure some of your listeners will remember, Hess flew from Germany to Britain during the war, bailed out of a plane, and tried, he said, to broker a peace between Germany and Great Britain. And the British did not take his peace overture seriously and imprisoned him for the duration of the war. And during that time, Hess developed some odd psychiatric symptoms, amnesia, various forms of paranoia. He believed that the British were trying to poison him through food, things like that. Mm-hmm. And he finally arrived in Nuremberg in September 1945. And he presented to Kelly a really interesting case. Was Hess really psychologically disordered, or was he faking it? And some of the book covers Kelly's efforts to find that out and to assess Hess and to figure out what was really going on in this man's mind. Eventually, Kelly determined that Hess was psychiatrically fit enough to stand trial, and that determination was supported by other psychiatrists who examined Hess. But Hess's case is very, very interesting.
And just to kind of give a little closure to Hess, could you tell us a little bit about the amazing statement, or confession, I guess you could say, that he makes during the trial? I just thought that was humorous, but also just very poignant in the entire story of what Kelly was trying to deal with these very manipulative men.
Well, several days into the trial, so this would be in December 1945, there was a court session, which was focused on Hess's mental state, mm-hmm. and whether he could successfully and in the interests of justice stand trial, given his mental state. And Hess's lawyer had made a motion for Hess's part of the trial, or his participation in the trial, to be postponed until it could be determined whether or not he was really mentally fit to stand trial. So that this session was going on, and in the middle of that, Hess had been taking notes and scribbling all kinds of things. His behavior in the courtroom was often very erratic and bizarre, mm-hmm. and so the court asked for Hess's opinion on all this, and he gave a statement which flabbergasted everyone, which was that he had been faking his amnesia all this time without the knowledge of his lawyer, and he denied all of the things, all of the lack of memories that he had professed in the months before, and it left everyone in the courtroom just dumbfounded, so dumbfounded that many people began laughing in the courtroom when he concluded this speech. Anyway, the session of the court ended right after that, and Hess went back to the jail part of the compound and said things like, paraphrasing him, "Fooled you all," that sort of thing. But he directed some of these comments toward Kelly, because Kelly, after all, was the psychiatrist who had assessed him. And
right.
Kelly believed that regardless of what Hess told the court, that Hess was not completely sound of mind, and that this type of confession was in line with the kind of neuroses that he believed Hess suffered from, and that he had predicted that Hess might do something like this. But Hess's, and, I don't know if it's possible to say that any of these men had a sad end. Most of them had the ends that they earned and deserved.
Mm-hmm.
But Hess, because of, I think, a little bit of uncertainty about his mental state, was sentenced to a life sentence instead of death by hanging, and lived a very long time, many more decades, in Spandau prison in Germany, and eventually took his own life when he was well advanced in age. And he was examined several times along the way by other psychiatrists, including another American psychiatrist who believed that Hess was mentally ill. But the Russians in particular, one of the four powers in control of the prison, did not want Hess released under any circumstances.
Right.
And so that's how Rudolf Hess ended.
Yeah, his story, I mean, all their stories are amazing, but every time I thought I had a firm understanding of Hess, he would change. He flies, he doesn't. You know, this is obviously not a mission sanctioned by Hitler. He flies to England. He's trying to get a peace. They don't want any part of it for Germany and Churchill. It's personal. It's going to go to the end. And then he fakes his amnesia or whatever. And then he admits it at the end. So he was a roller coaster ride all by himself. And it was entertaining but sad at the same time that he was so highly ranked and but obviously unstable to some degree.
Right, and he really challenged Kelly's professional abilities in the months that they had together. He was on Kelly's mind a lot.
Wow.
And I think that probably after Goering, Hess was the most interesting of the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly. There were a few others who drew a lot of his interest also. There was Alfred Rosenberg, who's covered in some detail in the book. He was the man who held the unofficial title of Nazi Party philosopher. He wrote books and was kind of the bearer of the Nazi Party philosophy. And another person who interested Kelly for other reasons was Julius Streicher, the anti-Semitic publisher and propagandist, who was scorned and disdained by the other prisoners. They often would not let him sit with them or eat with them.
That's amazing. Would it be fair to say that these two gentlemen that you just mentioned, would it be fair to say that both or either one of them were actually true believers, as opposed to this is the plank of our party and we're just going to do it because Hitler wants us to? Would you say that they really breathed in and believed the stuff that was coming out of Nazi Germany?
Well, Kelly believed that Rosenberg, in particular, was a true believer. Rosenberg had laid down these philosophic and pseudoscientific ideas about the Aryan race and racial purity, etc.
Yeah.
And Kelly believed that Rosenberg really believed them. He had repeated them so much that he had come to believe them and couldn't be moved from them by anything at all.
Wow.
And so their conversations were often nonsensical and very frustrating to Kelly.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. For me, the most interesting part of the whole book was when Kelly got permission to use the Rorschach test on the different Nazi leaders, and what he would be able to glean of that. And he had done it for a while. He was, I guess it's fair to say, he was really good. Had really experienced that interpreting the reaction from the test and be able to glean a lot out of what their response would be. Could you tell us some about that, please?
Yes. Years before Kelly had enlisted in the military, he had studied the Rorschach test in the late 1930s and had become one of the earliest American psychiatrists to advocate for the use of this test. And some of your listeners may know the Rorschach test involves showing patients or subjects a series of cards that were created by dropping ink on cards and mm-hmm. then folding them in half. So they were truly ink blots that didn't represent anything in reality. They
gotcha.
Were abstract images.
Okay.
And so the idea was that by showing these to someone and asking for their response, by asking them to tell what they see there, since it's a purely abstract image, then you can draw from the response a true kernel of what is going on in that person's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly became very skilled at interpreting Rorschach test results. And he brought the test to Nuremberg. I don't think it had been used much, if at all, in the U.S. military
right.
before that point, and administered the test to nearly all of the top 22 Nazis. And then repeat administrations of the test were given later by Kelly and by a psychologist who appeared a little later at the prison
mm-hmm.
named Gustav Gilbert. And so Kelly, as I said, was expert in interpreting these results. He wrote a lot of reports about what he drew from the Nazis' responses, and they are quite interesting. A few of the prisoners loved taking this test. Goering loved taking this test, and all of these guys were in solitary confinement. They were starved for attention from others, and so
right.
anything like this was sure to make many of them happy. But some refused to take part, or gave very brief, uninformative answers. Hess was among those who would just look at a card and shake his head or say, there's nothing there, or laugh
right.
and give responses like that.
I, just like Kelly, was sucked in by Goering's charm. If you were of his family or his immediate circle, he would do anything for you. But if you were outside of that, he seemed to really not care, especially about the millions of people dying. But he was very charming, very bombastic, and I think in a certain way, Kelly kind of fell into that, because I think he enjoyed, like you were saying, he enjoyed his time with Goering just as much as Goering enjoyed his time with him. It was like the clash of two titans, two huge egos, and two very intelligent, shrewd men. And I think Kelly practiced or was very good at magic and this whole sleight of hand. And I think they just enjoyed a certain, I don't know, comradeship or something when they got together in Goering's jail cell.
Exactly. I have characterize their encounters as King Kong versus Godzilla. I don't think I put that into the book, but that's certainly how I thought of it. And Kelly was truly confounded by Goering's very evident abilities,
yeah.
That he was intelligent. One of the tests that Kelly administered to the Nuremberg prisoners was the IQ test, and Goering scored among the highest. His score was 138, which is a very high IQ score.
Mm-hmm.
So Goering was clearly intelligent. He was charming. He was socially adept. He had good foresight. He could plan ahead. And Kelly was perplexed often how a man of such abilities could have committed such terrible crimes.
Yeah.
And the answer was that he lacked a conscience.
Mm.
Although, as you mentioned, he was a devoted husband, and a devoted father to his daughter. He could be a good friend, even a helpful friend to people who were close to him. He did not care about anybody else and thought nothing of issuing orders that would result in the deaths of thousands of people, of being an architect of the Holocaust, which resulted in the deaths of millions
right.
of people. So this was one of the psychological puzzles that Göring presented to Kelly that he tried to tease apart in the years after the war.
Yeah, I wish, as someone who tries to obey the law and be a good person, you wish all criminals were idiots and fools, but unfortunately that's not the way it works. You can be very intelligent, very cultured, but if you don't have empathy or morals, you're capable of doing a lot of bad things.
Yes, and that realization was one of the things that was very upsetting to Kelly as a result of his time at Nuremberg,
mm-hmm.
that the qualities that he saw in the Nazi war criminals were qualities that he saw in many, many other people, including business leaders back in the United States. He believed, Kelly came to believe that half the people in our country
right.
were capable of committing the kinds of acts that the Nazi leaders had, given the right circumstances.
Right. That's chilling and amazing all at the same time. So about halfway through your book, and you mentioned him already, Dr. Gilbert comes in, and I think you maybe described him as an interloper, at least into Dr. Kelly's world, but he didn't have the same rapport with Göring. So when he spent time with Göring, I think he saw, yeah, he's a general, he's smart, he's bombastic, but he wasn't as, I guess the word maybe, as impressed as Dr. Kelly was. Do you think he was a little more more clinical in his approach or his view of Göring, or maybe he got it wrong and Kelly got it right? I just find it interesting that one doctor saw Göring one way and one doctor saw him the other way.
That is interesting. Gilbert was a very different personality from Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
So Kelly was this very outgoing Boy Scout type. In fact, he had been an Eagle Scout in his youth and was gregarious, and he didn't look, speaking of Kelly now, he didn't look like most people would imagine a psychiatrist would look like. And he related to people differently than most people would imagine a psychiatrist would. So along comes Gilbert a little later, and his personality and approach is different. He is more academic in his personality and in his appearance, and Göring was just put off by him.
Right.
He felt that Gilbert was trying to poke holes in him, I think,
mm-hmm.
trying to deflate him. But Gilbert's approach did appeal to several of the other prisoners. They preferred Gilbert over Kelly. One of them was Albert Speer, who thought very highly of Gilbert, and definitely preferred him to Kelly. So where Gilbert and Kelly came into conflict was in how they would share all of the research and data they collected together in the later months after the war or after the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while they had an agreement going to co-author a book about the Nazi prisoners and the Nazi mind. But then Kelly broke that agreement and decided to go at it on his own and took home with him, brought home to the States from Germany all his papers, including some of Gilbert's papers and research. And there was a rift that formed between the two of them from that time forward. And they also differed in their interpretation of the data, too. So so two different men, and Gilbert's arrival on the scene did bring some conflict to the environment.
Oh, right. And Gilbert, I believe, was Jewish, but he didn't let the prisoners know that right away. Is that correct?
Gilbert was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may not have disclosed it for maybe the first couple of weeks, but
okay.
after that he was straightforward about it. But another advantage, so that could be seen with some of the prisoners as a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But a big advantage that Gilbert had over Kelly was that Gilbert was a fluent speaker of German.
Gotcha.
And so he could communicate very freely with some of the prisoners in ways that Kelly had difficulty doing.
Okay. And during this whole time I'm reading this, I just felt absolutely sorry for the warden. Colonel, how do you say his name, Andras?
Colonel Andrews.
I just felt so sorry for him trying to keep the circus all together without it falling apart.
He was one of the He is one of my favorite, secondary characters mm-hmm. in the book. He's a wonderful character. He tried to run the prison. He was the commandant of the prison, and he tried to run it in a in a tough but fair way, and I think succeeded overall. In doing that, he used, in his descriptions of what was going on at the time, he used very colorful language. He wrote a book about his experiences in Nuremberg that I drew from in my research. And, I think every time Colonel Andrews arrives on the scene, he brightens it up a little bit. Many of the prisoners did not like him at all.
Right.
They thought he was an overinflated peacock type.
Yeah.
Who made them salute him and address him in a particular way. But he's definitely one of the colorful figures in the book.
Yeah, because they were all former colorful peacocks, and now they're in prison. He's in charge, and he sees them for, as war criminals, and he's going to – because, he wasn't just in the Army. I think this was his job. He had experiences as far as prisoners and being a warden and stuff like that.
He had experience directing military prisons.
Gotcha. Thank you for saying what I was trying to say, and I couldn't get it out. Yeah. So the trial goes on, and it obviously takes a long time because they want to cover a lot of. And what I'll do for the readers is I'll skip some of the trial because we don't want to tell them everything. But I really enjoyed that part with was it Colonel Jackson who decided to be the prosecutor? Do I have his name right, Jackson?
Right, Robert Jackson.
Robert Jackson.
He was a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Who accepted the job of prosecuting the war criminals.
Okay. So what he was able to do, and he the fencing that went on between him and Goering over the weeks, I just found that really amazing, and he eventually just wore Goering down, who tried to, deter as much as he could. So all these men are tried, and I guess some of them were hung. Some of them were, like Hess, life in prison. Were some of them executed by firing squad?
No.
Okay.
All the ones who were executed were hanged, and this was a problem for Goering, who mm-hmm. believed that execution by hanging was demeaning. Which it unquestionably is.
Right.
And he asked the prison authorities to be executed by firing squad instead, but that request was turned down.
Right. Did the Americans, or I guess the Allies, did they choose to hang them purposely with the idea of not something as honorable as a firing squad? Did they want them to be seen as criminals who were found guilty, or is that just the way it was done at the time?
They were convicted of criminal charges, mm-hmm. and I believe the four powers wanted them executed as criminals.
Gotcha.
Not only that, but they wanted to prevent the Nazis from inspiring the start of some sort of worshipful movement later on. And so, after the hangings, the bodies were incinerated in the ovens at Dachau. And were scattered after that so that nobody could make a shrine around a place of burial.
Yeah, the irony of that just stunned me. That was absolutely amazing. Because I think Goering was saying he totally expected to be in the history books, a couple of decades as one of Germany's greatest heroes or leaders. And he just, I don't know if that was real or if he was losing it at the end, but the Americans were very fearful of the post-war world, and they're trying to get Germany on their side to help face the Russians. So it was a very complex time for the Allies, trying to punish, but at the same time, they have to deal with the Germany that is after the war.
And even the trial was conducted in some danger. There's very high security. There's a lot of fear that that renegade German forces would try and break in and free the top Nazis. Kelly recorded some conversations among the prisoners during the trial, in which Kelly tried to rally their spirits and told them that in the future there would be marble monuments to them and
right.
things like that. Goering above all wanted all of the defendants to present a solid uniform face to the court.
Mm.
He did not want anyone breaking down or admitting guilt, and that's why he exhorted them to, that was in their future.
That's amazing. Now, okay, so speaking of Gary, do we know definitively how he got the poison into his cell, or is it speculation or rumors? Or, you know, because even I can see him at the end toying with the warden saying, I had this poison in my cell the entire time and your men never found it. Even if that wasn't true, I could easily see him writing a letter like that just to taunt his captor.
Right. There is a lot of speculation about what happened and how Goering managed to commit suicide the day before his scheduled hanging using cyanide capsule. I believe, and I think the evidence supports a belief, that Goering did have cyanide with him all along throughout his entire captivity, and that he managed cleverly to hide these glass vials on his body or in different parts of his cell throughout all those months.
Wow.
There is speculation that, among others, that various people may have smuggled the poison to him, whether it was a American guard or a visitor or one of his lawyers. But I think he had it with him all along. And if he did receive assistance from, say, an American guard, it may have been in retrieving the cyanide from his belongings, stored belongings. But he was clever and determined, and he got what he wanted in the end.
That's amazing. So he was going to see how far he could get with Kelly in the trial, and when it didn't work out, he had his own exit strategy, and he was going to stay the master of his own fate up until the very end. I just think it's amazing. He wasn't going to go out any other way than what he wanted to do.
Yes, and Kelly wrote about this afterwards, because Goering's suicide surprised Kelly and shook him up quite a bit, and he believed that Goering had pulled off a coup. He had succeeded by taking his own life. He had succeeded in mocking the American authorities by presenting his death to the world in the way that was best to Goering. And he was amazed at Goering's gall and ability to pull that off.
Okay, that's just because, he certainly admired him, and then to find out that he took his own life, it probably just ran counter to what he probably thought of Goering, or the impression that Goering gave him. So what happens to Dr. Kelly after the trial and the suicide of Goering?
Well, Kelly returned to the States and left the military during the trial, actually, in January 1946. So he was replaced at Nuremberg by another psychiatrist who took over things from there. And Kelly came home. He was very shook up by his experience in Nuremberg, in the sense that the psychiatric results that he had gotten from all his tests and assessments of the prisoners were not what he expected, and it caused him to do a lot of serious thinking about psychiatry and what he wanted to do with his life. And in fact, Kelly decided to leave the practice of psychiatry after Nuremberg and become a criminologist, to become an academic criminologist, so that he could devote more time to studying criminal behavior as opposed to psychiatric behavior. He had learned that there was a difference between the two. And So he taught for a few years and directed a psychiatric clinic at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, and then moved to the University of California at Berkeley, where he joined the School of Criminology there as a professor. And his especially when he moved to California, his life kind of jumped off the rail.
Mm-hmm.
He began this this agonizing spiral downward. He became a workaholic, an alcoholic. He had problems in his marriage. He had anger problems.
Right.
He had this terrible temper that he couldn't often contain. And the book, my book goes into how this is related to his time at Nuremberg and the conclusions that he had drawn from his study of the Nazis.
Wow.
And in the end, and this isn't a spoiler since I write about it on page two of the book, he took his own life in front of his family.
Wow.
Using the very same poison, cyanide, that Goering had used to end his life.
That's amazing. Do you think he meant for his family to see it, or did it just kind of work out that way, or was he just maybe the rage, who knows, controlled him at that moment?
He was overtaken by anger and frustration and despair.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier in our interview Kelly's experience as a magician. Kelly was a stage magician. For much of his life, and very good at it too, and I think that plays into the effect that he was trying to achieve when he was standing in front of his family holding the cyanide, and then he was just overtaken. I don't want to get too much more into it because it's a big part of the ending section of the book, and I don't want to spoil anything for readers, but he was an immensely complicated man, and part of his complication had been tied up together at Nuremberg.
Right. That is absolutely amazing. And for my listeners, they know that Goering was instrumental in helping Hitler rise to power because he had a lot of contacts with people that, quite frankly, Hitler did not. And I guess in some ways maybe Dr. Kelly was the one who really got inside Goering's mind, maybe more than anyone else. And yeah, the connection between his time at Nuremberg and then later on in his life is really fascinating as well. Obviously, don't want to go into details. Leave that for your readers. But it was just an amazing story. And after I finished reading, I went to sleep. I mean, I had dreams about Goering. I could just picture him sitting across the table from me and laughing and joking and carrying on as long as I was his friend or he was in a good mood. But then there were times when he would get angry at his the other prisoners, and you could just see how he could order the end of someone's life, and it really wouldn't bother him that much. So he was just an amazing, in a very strange way, a very amazing man with great depth in a good way and a bad way.
Haunting. He was a haunting
perfect
figure. And,
yeah.
And I think Kelly is haunting too, in his similar way, which is what drew me to the topic and made me want to write this book. I should add for your listeners that if anyone would like to learn more about Goering and Kelly in the book, they can find that on my website.
Okay.
Is it all right if I...
Absolutely, please.
...the URL? It's my name, Elhai, which is spelled ELHAI.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there you'll find more information about the book, an excerpt, and a video book trailer, too.
That's amazing. Yeah, I have to admit that in the interest of time to be able to be ready for this interview, I had to go to Audible, so I got my copy from Audible. So for all you people out there who commute all the time, it's also as well on Audible. And even though you didn't read it for Audible, which I kind of wish you had, the reader did a very good job, and he really took it to another level and made it very entertaining and engaging. So for those of you who like that, please check out Audible as well.
Yes, I agree. The actor, the narrator, who read The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, did a wonderful job, far better than I would have done. And well, I am glad that he did it.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. Now, did I? Maybe I read this wrong in preparing. But do you have another book coming out? I thought I read something.
Well, I guess it's fair to say I always have another book coming up, but because I love writing books. But right. It's nothing that has yet been contracted or that I should talk about.
Okay, that's fine. Well, I just want to thank you again for taking the time with us. I absolutely enjoyed your book, and I learned so much. And, you know, that besides being entertained, that's what it's all about. And I'm glad you stumbled upon those cardboard boxes of notes and were able to turn it into something coherent. So, go ahead.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed talking with you about all this. And, I just want to add that writing the book has been a fantastic adventure for me. And part of my goal in the book was to communicate that adventure, for this remarkable story to the people who read it.
Okay. So Mr. Jack L. High, thank you very much for being with us. Everyone check it out. It's The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, Hermann Goering, Dr. M. Kelly, and A Fatal Meeting of the Minds at the End of World War II. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.